You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Kia ora, my name is Jamie Hanton, and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Based in central Christchurch since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to achieve a higher level of professional and creative development and encourage a greater acknowledgement, understanding, and value of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate. Welcome to episode 6 of Art Not Science. In this final episode of 2019, we are very proud to present part 1 of Hamster 5. Hamster is a serial publication produced by the Physics Room that responds to issues in contemporary art and publishing. Issue 5 focuses on themes of embodiment, performance, and relationships. This issue of Hamster is the first time the publication has been produced simultaneously as an audiobook. You can listen to the whole audiobook or read a PDF of the magazine on the Physics Room website. Physical copies of the magazine will be available from our new gallery space in the Arts Centre in 2020. First up in this episode is editor of Issue 5, Hamish Peterson, with the foreword, entitled Cooked Stones. Following this is Lemons by Lindley Edmead, then Tupono by Pooh Cody Productions, and finally we have Sometimes My Layers Clash With Your Layers by Jennifer Catherine Shields.
Cooked Stones. Mishearings and Hauntings. It's late October, and I'm listening to Lindley read their text for this issue from the WAV file they sent through over the weekend. It's around 8:45 a.m, so the streets are still a focused, organized hustle, and the office is yet to be fully populated. The cloud cover keeps the peace for now, before we're all mixed up in one another's priorities, CCs, and to-dos. I've read their text many times by now, but I hear Lindley in my headphones telling me how N left the waiting room at the front of the emergency department to cool off. In the rain, N is cooking stones. A black-handled saucepan appears in my head, lined with grey river stones, hot, hissing, steaming. It's a week earlier, and we are together in the afternoon, bathing in warm light through gabled windows. Brooke is a rancher, cracking bullwhips, a therapist on the floor, a teacher, Martha Graham, Trisha Brown, and their former dancing selves. These pasts haunt Brooke in gestures and are announced to the room as apparitions fleeing between their teeth. We had spent the whole weekend talking about the only person we both knew, eating and slipping in between disciplines. I'm saying we never really danced for each other till now. All the while, the friends I had knotted into Brooke's harness had been excavating the space between them and channeling a step sequence. Anxieties and utterances. I hit reply. I tap the glowing icon. Vanessa reads my mind as I toss up whether I should watch their Instagram story before replying to their email. The dust of their visit has settled, and we email back and forth about the shape of a draft. Should it be long? An essay? Reflection? Dare I say poetry? Or screenshots? Delivery expectation, set, reset. Being in relation produces something of value. It writes into existence relationships, certain agreed-upon terms of engagement, boundaries, and support that are both unseen and valuable, and it writes them into our memories of one another. Why put it in a Google Doc if we did it all weekend? I copy and paste Robin's address into my GChat window, type out a message to them, ready to call when you are, talk soon. The bar on the window lights up green and I accept. I see Robin's face and smile. It's barely 3 months since we released the last magazine. I can still picture the spreadsheet full of names, pending orange boxes and alarming reds. Seeing Robin glitch onto my screen, seeing their face, reminds me what it means to be recognized as a loving, caring, struggling moral body, and capable of making a concrete contribution to a material community. We talk about autoimmune disorders like long-lost primary school friends. I walk through that memory now, like Robin teaches us to. And I feel less like an art factory or a word machine. Implications, sensations, divinations. To read their words and know how they felt. To sit in a room and know you're seen. To achieve recognition in the folds of a conversation and the turns of an interaction. I feel like I've snuck into the cinema, even though Jen invited me to this dinner party. I had to pull the leaf out to extend the tables. Demand will not be sated. Everyone wants to get out of the gender industrial complex before it eats them alive. But how do you ask kindly for the salt and start the conversation when it might drown you? To feel the horses gallop in slow motion, like how we slump down the couch on a hot platonic night. Gemma FaceTimes me from Sydney, a public park, and I remember their sci-fi projections from university, and again in the gallery, when I started interning at the physics room. I never knew them as a writer, even though their installations involved long stories in green text. Drafts come through, and I read stanzas with music in my head. Sentimental country ballads, dub rhythm, quiet death metal, spiritual jazz. These are feelings I know from before. To sense guidance. To walk into your arms in the dark, sense your shadow, to guess, offer, show up, and stick around. A friend and artist once told me that they trusted me to share parts of their story because I was a close friend of their friends. This made our interactions and their consequences intrinsically linked to the people who brought us together. Trust accountable to a community. When Pucody Productions first came into the gallery to look at rehearsal spaces, the process of carrying on relations from the crosshatched friends, whānau, and ancestors who brought us here spilled over into what we did in that fleshy space. Braids left loose at the end. I want to account for the relationships that I've experienced in the process of telling the stories in this issue. It feels yucky to talk about myself in the middle of all this, but to not enunciate my Pākehā, immigrant, and cis male passing self in the editorial position is to ignore the sight of decision-making. So I've tried to make decisions that deepen my accountability to the writers we've published. We invited three contributors to come to Ototahi as weekend residents, to make work that required being in the same room as others, and therefore me, and tried to see the four other writers face-to-face wherever possible, to edit, to pitch, to question, to confirm. To call people into a shared and enfleshed materiality makes the risk of trust, faith, honesty, commitment, recognition, labor, resources, power, and precarity more readily perceivable. What is at stake is realized by the decisions you and I make in the attention between our faces. The moments of recognition between us are what provided the space to write what we needed to. Writing happened in the space between our bodies and faces in time that might be called non-productive. But Robin, Jennifer, Lindley, Gemma, Kim, Cherie, Fualili, Brooke, Charlie, Michaela, and Vanessa have all shown me how valuable the time after the proposal, but before anyone starts typing, is. When we talk, fidget, think, joke, eat, and play together. When we first reside beside each other, being together is risky. I mishear you, you disagree with me, and that produces something between us. I want to call that writing.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space. Next up is Lemons by Linley Edmeads.
Lemons. I've started feeling the baby move. It first happened at Mitre 10. We were looking for a new broom. I thought my phone was vibrating. You didn't bring your phone, said N. Our baby was vibrating. I have an app called Flow. Every week it sends me an update to tell me what size the baby is. This week it is as big as a Napa cabbage. I've never bought a Napa cabbage before, never even picked one up in a supermarket, so this information means very little to me. Flo tells me that I may be experiencing some difficulty sleeping due to the increased pressure on my bladder and an inability to find a comfortable spot. But don't worry, it says. The baby will be out in 8 weeks. I quickly close the app and open something else. Boris Johnson has declared his commitment to a no-deal Brexit. I read 3 articles about it so that I don't have to think about how there are only 8 weeks left, about how I don't even know if I want this. I haven't slept for 2 days. I haven't slept for 2 days because I can't lie down. I can't lie down because my right shoulder is doing something very weird and very painful. I try watching a movie. I have to do it standing up. I haul out all the spare blankets to ward off the cold, and when the movie is over, I have a 40-minute shower. Then I watch another movie. I ignore the tightness in my pelvis because all my attention is on my shoulder, in an endless loop of why is this happening? Why is it so sore? Can I take that codeine I found in the bathroom? I'll Google it. No, I can't take it. How often can I take paracetamol? How much paracetamol is considered dangerous? Why is this happening? When N wakes up, he takes me to the doctor. The doctor gives me a script of Norflex, a muscle relaxant, and the names of some apps for calmness and relaxing. I swallow 2 pills and wait. When nothing happens, I cry and panic and pace some more. In calls the midwife. Take her to ED, she says. While we wait to be seen in ED, I walk between the chair at the back of the room and the toilet several hundred times. There is a game show playing on the television above reception. It has one of the Spice Girls on it. She is trying to push round discs over the edge of a ledge to try to win money. The volume is muted, but we all watch it because there is nothing else to look at when we get bored of our phones. I try sitting down. At one point, I lean over the chair. The receptionist puts her head out from behind the perspex and asks N if I've gone into labour. No, it's her shoulder, he says. Oh, that's okay then, she replies. The Spice Girl fails to push the coloured disc over the edge that will bring her all the money in the world. N looks distressed. I tell him to go outside. It is raining. Through the glass doors, I watch him kicking stones before coming back inside and buying some bliss balls from the vending machine in the entranceway. In the waiting room, nurses come and go from some mysterious place behind the doors. They shuffle our folders around. Pink and blue and green and yellow plastic folders with triage notes. I hear one of them say, shoulder pain, you've got to be kidding. The man with gout in his foot tells me that the folders with the pink stripes are the ones for the people who come by ambulance. They get priority, so that's why they keep shuffling things around. You're better off paying the $90 for the big white taxi, just so you don't have to wait out here for hours, he says. At AD, they ask me what my pain is on a scale of 1 to 10. I'm still crying and say, maybe 8, with more question than answer in my voice. I look around the waiting room. Here we all are together, I think, in our various pains. How can anyone judge their own pain scale? That man with the gout, the young girl with what may be appendicitis. If I had a different personality, maybe I'd say 10. I think that my pain is not as bad as other people's, but who am I to know? Everyone looks so miserable. At least I'm not in labour. That must be a number 10, surely. In hospital, the baby moves all night, as if to say, I'm still here. I see another pregnant woman, but she's here to sit beside her husband's bed while he dozes in and out of morphine dreams, perhaps. I see her looking at me, and she sees me looking at her. We must be about the same. 26 weeks. A doctor comes to see me in the middle of the night. He brings a nurse who wheels a machine along beside her, and he tells me they're going to do an ultrasound on my legs. I am in the middle of a morphine cycle, and so I smile and I think that this is the most beautiful man in the world. When he tells me to lie back and lift up my gown so he can take a look at my upper legs, I tell him I've still got my knickers on. He says, that's good, and smiles. I think about this a lot the next day. I tell Ian when he comes back to see me in the hospital, and he tells me not to worry. He's really lovely, says Ian. And besides, doctors must hear shit like that all the time. I stop worrying. In the hierarchy of worries, this one has been knocked off the list. They do lots of tests. After 24 hours, they tell me I can go home. It's musculoskeletal, they say, and that an osteopath or a physiotherapist may be able to help me. In the weeks following, the pain begins to ease, but like some kind of infection, it spreads down my arm. The osteopath tells me this is my nerves and that my rotator cuff has been damaged. You've made a right mess of this shoulder, he says. I imagine a city after an earthquake, all that damage just below the surface. The liquefaction may be my many tears. This is the first time I've been to an osteopath. He straps me up so I can't move my shoulders. The next time I see him, he tells me I have to start moving. I nod and wonder why I feel like he's a little bit angry with me. Yes, I need to start moving, I agree. Shall I go swimming or something? No, you just need to get moving. I sit on the edge of the massage bed in my bra and jeans, and he stands at his desk, drinking his coffee and watching me move my shoulder back and forth, then tells me he has to make a phone call before leaving the room. I sit and stare at myself in the mirror, swollen and protruding, while moving my shoulder back and forth in sets of 10. When he comes back, he says, that's good. I scold myself later for feeling like I'd finally done something right. Afterwards, I go to the supermarket and park too close to the trolley return bay. I cry when I can't fit out the door and drive home instead, thinking the bananas can wait. Today I received 2 parcels, 1 postcard, and a large brown paper bag full of pre-cooked meals. 1 parcel from my mother has 8 lemons, 2 bars of chocolate, a bar of fancy soap, and a bottle of vitamin C. The other, a gift from my aunt, is an outfit for a newborn in a DVD of my cousin's funeral that I couldn't go to. I write a eulogy for my sister to read, a letter from our unborn child. I am already putting words in their mouth. I make an appointment with a Chinese herbalist, recommended to me by a friend. When I tell him about my shoulder and that I'm 31 weeks pregnant, he says, "No problem, we fix you with no medicine." I don't tell him I've been taking codeine for the last 24 days and that I've also just gone back on antidepressants. I go to see another osteopath. This one is younger and a bit cheaper. I like how he pulls my arm into his chubby tummy and holds it in his soft pillow. I like his big ginger beard and his kind eyes. He doesn't ask me to take my top off. I remember going to visit a friend of mine when she was almost 8 months pregnant. She had swollen ankles and insisted on wearing skin-coloured ballet flats. There was no telling where her feet began. Only several days after I saw her, she was admitted to hospital with preeclampsia and went into labour very soon afterwards. I remember thinking, I won't do it like that. One day I'm sitting on the bed reading. I start to feel sick and then like I need to shit. I go to stand up and then I faint. When I come to, I sit on the edge of the bed and wonder if I'm dying. I think, this is it. I fucked it up so bad that I'm going into labour 9 weeks early. I try and do some deep breathing. I call the midwife. She sounds like she has a cold, and I ask her if she is okay. She tells me she has just woken up. It is 3:20 p.m. A wee baby came in the night, she says. That could be my baby, I think. She tells me it might be my low blood pressure that makes me faint, and that standing up is the worst thing I can do in that situation, which makes me feel silly. She tells me not to worry, that it won't be affecting the baby. I can feel the tears coming, so I thank her 3 times before hanging up. I call in at work and cry. Then I have a bath and cry some more. Then I get out of the bath and Google fainting while pregnant. The baby kicks. Because of my shoulder and my depression, I stopped working. I didn't think it would be like this. I thought I would just keep going until the end. I even imagined being mid-lecture when my waters broke and found myself Googling things like, how will I know when my waters break, and how much water actually comes out. Another parcel arrives. This one has lemons and vitamin C, but also contains some children's books. When I call my mother to say thank you, I feel guilty that I can't be bothered listening to the 15-minute story about how she found the books. When I get off the phone, I feel frustrated and then I feel guilty about that too. Because I can't sit at the desk or a table, I do everything from the bed. There are large piles of books and papers on the floor and on the dresser in the bedroom. The bed used to be a sacred space, just for sleeping, resting, making love. The house feels messy and everything feels unfinished. I have to excuse myself many times from commitments, always ending my emails with, under normal circumstances, and if it were just me I had to think about. I'm pretty sure I'm still only thinking about me in all of this, but I don't say that. In her book, Mothers, Rachel Zucker tells a story about how she can't stop crying months after her friend has died. Her therapist tells her, "It's good that you're crying." I misread this as, "You are good at crying." I am good at crying. We go to a first birthday party. I feel nauseous and sit on a beanbag that later I won't be able to get out of without help, stuffing my face with a bagel and watching other people's kids loll around on the ground like miniature versions of their not very interesting parents. On the way home, I say to Ian, "I don't want any of that." "It's like life just stops," he says. He looks over at me as we're driving through South Dunedin, and I realize that I'm making a weird noise in my throat. "Are you okay?" he asks. The gurgle in the back of my throat turns into uncontrollable weeping. My GP makes an appointment with the Plunkett mental health nurse. Her name is Joy, and she looks a bit like my mum. She offers me a cup of tea, and then when she asks me how I am, I start to cry. She puts the tissues in front of me. "What's your worst fear?" she asks. "That I won't like it," I say. She gives me several pamphlets about mindfulness, writes down the names of apps, and tells me to think about things like 5-minute walks around the garden, diaphragmatic breathing, and support networks. I want to leave, but I don't have anywhere to go. Her tissues are really soft. Zucker says she always wanted to be a mother. I don't recognize that feeling. I have had arguments with others who have had the decision taken away from them, an age or an illness, somehow convinced that they were more fortunate than me, for they didn't actually have to decide. The absurdity and arrogance of this embarrasses me so much, I almost shudder when I think about it now. When I lie in the bath, I can see small ripples forming on the surface when the baby moves. In the silence of my empty house on a Monday afternoon, lying in tepid bathwater, I apologize to this little being for not being able to grow them properly, for already being a fuck-up. I meet a friend for dinner who I haven't seen for a while. "Look at you," he says. People can say this kind of thing now. My body is a talking point. He makes sure I have a comfy chair to sit in and checks what I can eat before he orders for us both. After dinner, he says, "Can I ask you a personal question?" When I consent, he asks me if I'm scared. He is almost 60 and childless. I feel so relieved that someone has finally asked. "Yes," I say, "I'm terrified." When I get home, more lemons have arrived.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space. That was Lemons by Linley Edmeads. Our next reading is Tūpono by Pooh Cody Productions.
Tūpono, a play by Kim Garrett, music by Cherie Waithoa. Serendipity, chance. Tūpono, to come upon accidentally, happen by chance, chance upon. Do things happen by chance, or do things happen for a reason? Does life present us with golden opportunities, or is it our job to make it happen? Are we alone in this life, or are there forces greater than us that watch, guide, and protect us during our journey? Are there signs to help guide us? And even if there were, would we see them? I know what I believe. I am a storyteller, and to share our story into, through, and beyond the residency weekend offered by the Physics Room, I will use a beginning, a middle, and an end. This story will tell of the relationships that brought us together, and the relationships we created, the performance we envisioned, and the process it took to embody that vision effectively, creatively, and authentically. The responses and feedback to the work and the process, and the constructive criticism and steps we as a company hope to take moving forward. I believe trust and authentic action are required in writing, devising, building relationships, and embodying concepts through performance. I believe people are brought together for a reason. And music is a powerful force that can manipulate energies. A picture is worth a thousand words. And we are not alone. I believe love finds a way to heal. Our story, Tūpuno, encompasses themes like this and in a lot of ways reflects our own journey as a company. Tūpuno is a story involving two individuals at their lowest and darkest times and the forces that surround them, guide and protect them. Meeting unexpectedly, or were they guided, they discover a connection so instant, baffling, illogical, strong and spiritual, so empowering, and yet they are powerless to control it. Serendipity, fate, or divine intervention? They mirror each other, reflecting masses of talent, deep pain, hurt, hope, courage, strength, intuition, beauty, and love. Through vulnerability, sharing their stories and songs, they find safety in each other, trust, respect, and admiration. A side effect of letting someone in, even though one feels broken and ugly, is the pay it forward ripple effect. Through encouraging the other to see their worth, they find their own. Together, they find their voice, they find their creativity, they find the strength and courage to shine their lights, they find their connection to a higher power, and they find love. Love for each other, and the most important love of all, self-love. A moment's deviation from the beginning of our story to introduce the characters. Kieran Ortley-Ryan, the catalyst to this divine opportunity, a trusted and respected colleague, and more importantly, an admired and loved friend. Pukodi Productions, the protagonists, a company with a desire to connect, communicate, and create. The Physics Room and Hamish Peterson, the courageous organisation challenging and supporting creatives to be vulnerable, share their truth, and to expose their process, to show a behind-the-scenes how-to of the multiple facets of writing, devising, and creating. The Arts Centre, who entrusted us with the environment for the writing and creation of Tūpuno. John Russell, the student seeking a creative collaboration for his own development as a writer and creative. The man with a project, a camera, a head full of fantastic ideas, and a generosity of spirit. Our photo credits go to him, and our thanks for the secret weapon he brought along, his whānau. The Russell whānau, creators of a positive, loving whānau support system, a system which encouraged community, faith, and trust. Were they guided to us because we needed them? I like to think so. The beginning, Angitu, the opportunity. The story begins with a call to apply for a weekend residency with the Physics Room. A call to workshop our story. The seed of a story which had been shared during the chance conversation at a random get-together. I believe we are presented with opportunities. On offer, a space where thought can be action and the time to connect, communicate and create. I believe it's our job to take up opportunities and make it happen. Pukodi Productions applied and were accepted for the weekend residency. Challenge accepted. Now to deliver. Now to collaborate. First contact, the Physics Room and Hamish. The man who can get anything done with a smile and some good old ingenuity. Hamish was first and last point of contact once we were offered the residency. He led us every step of the way, helping us find the right space within the Arts Centre for our workshop, the Maker's Workshop, welcoming us and the other residents, playing tour guide, chef, friend, and procurement officer, supporting with ideas, practically helping set up the space and troubleshoot, taking on roles of stage manager, production manager, front of house, usher, operator, tech, marketing, and friend. The middle, whakaaro, the process from our perspective. The art of performance that builds relationships and bridges gaps is one of the most rewarding feelings. Bringing whānau together for even a moment in time is what we share through the collaboration of arts and performance.
This residency provided Pukauri Productions with an opportunity to discover how we deliver content in a theatrical environment, offering us a space to celebrate the love for sound that makes you move, words that stimulate thought, and connection through emotional association, using dance to allow the viewer to interpret as they will. All forms of communication were explored during the residency, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, providing Pukauri Productions the platform and space to collaborate. We love to connect, create, and communicate.
Sense of smell, guiding me to follow. Oh, 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 oh.
Our decision to have a live musician feeding into the play, creating and adding to the atmosphere, supporting the songs. We were lucky enough to have the songwriter as our muso. Cherie generated live soundscapes using traditional Māori and non-traditional instruments, and she sang and accompanied her songs for the performance. From the audience response, I discovered we created an enhanced experience of and a stronger connection to the emotional and spiritual journey of the whakaari. This reinforces for me the importance of the live musician. Their job requires them to breathe with the piece and almost imperceptibly shift the atmosphere. They read not only the performers and the differing energies of each performance, but they read the audience too. They improvise within the structure of the story to allow the story to unfold more deeply for the audience. I absolutely love this experience working with two awesome and talented wahine. This was a massive learning and trusting experience for me. This play pushed me out of my comfort zone, and for the first time, I danced in front of an audience. What I learned from this play was the importance of trusting in yourself and others.
With themes of loss, self-worth, the healing power of music, spirituality and love, we chose to use shadow dancers as a representation of divine masculine and feminine energies, and to build a spiritual world that watches, guides, and protects those in the realm of the living. We explored realistic and abstract forms of movement and representation to create a spiritual realm. We combined Māori performing arts and physical movement or dance. This was well received. And though our equipment was limited and our space meant limited hours for working with shadow, we saw huge potential for a shadow world and shadow dancers, and this will definitely be a part of the final product.
Fear and doubt, confidence and trust. These contradictory energies shifted constantly within me during this process. They're still here as I attempt to write this article. My fear of not being an academic, yet writing for a publication, which will be filled with extraordinarily talented people, articulating and communicating with aptitude and talent. Ooh, my imagination runs away with me. I'm intimidated and insecure, but choose to feel the fear and do it anyway. Keep pushing myself out of my comfort zone to see what I can find. I find when you collaborate with the right people for the right reasons and all involved are willing to work hard, you can achieve a great deal in a very short amount of time. This experience was essential for me as a creative, and it was a pleasure. It has deepened my respect and admiration for my colleagues' talents. It has reinforced my own trust in my ideas and creativity, and it has shown me we have the beginnings of something special. Our story touched people's hearts. It made them think of spirituality and what that means to them. It made them laugh. They left wanting Cherie's songs on their playlist, and they left seeing the full story in their heads. I couldn't ask for more. bend, huanga, findings. The physics room laid out an exciting brief to the public that was full of scope and great questions to stimulate creativity. Now, this is an exciting brief, full of scope and great questions to stimulate creativity. We at Pukodu Productions appreciate the time and space we had to examine and discover the processes which work for us and serve our story best. We loved the opportunity to bring together a dancer, an actor, and a musician to devise a show using each other's strengths and supporting each other's weaknesses. It felt like a step in the right direction to be a part of the expansion and diversification of people and bodies collaborating, sharing spaces and knowledge in our communities. Doubt was felt, but trust was still given and shared. A script was written. Movement was choreographed. Songs and music were developed and created. An environment was fashioned. Collaborators generously and tirelessly went above and beyond. A performance was shared. Feedback was exchanged. And now, the final step is this written response to the entire experience. And so it is done. The end. Or maybe I should say the beginning. For this opportunity has shown us this story deserves a chance. It is our intention to present this story to New Zealand and eventually to the world, and it would be serendipitous to see you there.
You're listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space. That was Tūpono by Pukodu Productions. Finally, we have Sometimes My Layers Clash With Your Layers by Jennifer Catherine Shields.
This piece is an act of processing in response to a number of topics the Hamsterfied brief brought up. As part of the process, an open workshop was held in which people came together to discuss questions such as, what is bodily practice? Is there a non-bodily practice? And what does it mean to work or create with people whose bodies are treated the same way as yours? During this discussion, people also created collages, badges, and blackout poetry from the physics room's archival material, old National Geographics, and cheap romance novels. Only those with bodies who are treated as the norm are able to escape bodily practice. To be clear, their practice is still bodily, but they have the luxury of not thinking about it that way, because their bodies are the default. Certain processes aim to dissociate the body from the text. Academic texts are peer-reviewed, made objective, attempting to excise the body. The body should be in the text at all times. We need to reassociate the body with the text. I only have one body. Things are always in process, always connected to pasts and futures. When Venn diagrams cross over, certain things get easier. Working with others who have similar bodily experiences can be revolutionary, simply because of the amount of work that has already been done, because of the shared understanding between the collaborators. Reading trans fiction by trans authors changed my life. This form of collaboration between writer and reader who both have similar bodily experiences has been revolutionary. I have encountered and discovered experiences I had already had but not acknowledged. Collaborating across identities, writing personal, intimate pieces, reading and writing is a means of collaborating across generations, across time and history, with those who are no longer here. I am interested in the notion of reading someone's work as an act of collaboration. I think it makes sense. The writer writes, and that is the thesis. The reader approaches the work with their lived experience, and that is the antithesis. The act of reading is an act of synthesis, an act of collaboration. I believe this act has revolutionary capabilities. With this understanding, the act of sharing of any work at any stage in the creative process also has revolutionary capabilities. I remember the first time I collaborated with another trans person. They edited a significant text I wrote. It was easy, I felt comfortable because we had a shared understanding, a shared politic. Even though we were working in an institutional space, this connection, this collaboration, this mode of working made the director uncomfortable. In 2014, 91 years after the term transsexual was coined, I sit in a dark room and watch Sylvia Rivera take the stage at the 1973 Gay Pride Rally in New York. I watch as the crowd boo and jeer. My heart fills with love and hope as she, speaking to me across decades, leans on the mic stand and stares back at the crowd, defiant. I wrote this poem for the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Queer history has always been important to me. Watching that video of Sylvia Rivera changed my life and set me on a path I was always meant to follow. It really did feel like she was speaking directly to me. Everything I do now, when thinking about and working with queer history, is trying to generate that feeling for others. When I read that poem, I read parts of her speech. In those moments, I want to embody Sylvia as much as I can. Sometimes it is not just myself on the stage. I am no longer in 2019, but neither am I in 1973. We are somewhere in between. In the film It Follows, the horror is embodied in someone who is possessed by it, and they slowly and methodologically chase, at walking pace, the last person they had sex with. I feel like I'm in that movie, but the horror is capitalism, always slowly chasing me, always attempting to capture and define my identity. Non-binary genders are now marketable. What was once, and still is to some extent, outside the norm, is now a marketing category. I open Facebook, start creating a new ad, and sigh with relief when I see I can target men, women, or all. Capitalism is still alive because it finds ways to subsume the things that would kill it. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. An act of perverse collaboration, but one in which there is no respect or care, simply greed for survival and accumulation. This is a mode of collaboration we must try and avoid. In It Follows, the only way to survive is to have sex with someone else, and even then it only puts another person in between you and the horror. You are still on the list. I see more and more of us reaching out for queer history. Watching these histories play out in shows like Pose give me hope. Although a B-plot, watching the story of ACT UP play out on screen in a mass media format feels significant. It feels significant to see queer and trans people of colour running the show, writing the show, acting in the show, and increasing visibility of these stories and identities. I worry to what extent these histories are being subsumed by normative capitalism, being used as a tool to continue that ideology. We are in a moment where we need to learn our histories. I am lucky to have not personally experienced the impact of AIDS. I am part of a generation that has been told that all the queer struggles have been solved. I have experienced intergenerational conflict like this. I believe the way forward is intergenerational connection. I was at an event recently where multiple generations of queer folk were in the same room, speaking about their experiences, about the ways they have experienced their bodies being policed, being surveilled, being co-opted. That was a revolutionary moment. I spoke to people of generations above me who had their eyes opened that night, shifting from, "We fought the fight, the kids have it all right," to, "I had no idea what they were struggling with and I have some learning to do." This is the power of collaboration. This highlights the way collaboration across, between, and through bodily experience can create radical change. Collaborating with others with different experiences, though often more difficult, can be beneficial, for both parties or just one. Collaborating across lines of privilege when you are the one holding that privilege requires responsibility and respect. How do we navigate this best for growth, for both parties, without exploitation or appropriation? Dichotomies and binaries are always limiting. There is space between the poles, outside the poles, space so distant from the poles that the poles aren't even recognizable anymore. In our community, we talk a lot about passing. For many, it is an end goal, understandably so. Passing can bring massive amounts of safety, but passing is not something innate to yourself or your body. Passing is conditional and changes in every single interaction you have, every time anyone perceives you. You have no control over it, not really. Really, almost everything about our bodies is like this. Even though our bodies should be our own, they exist most when they are perceived. Or perhaps they exist least when being perceived, our own tangible body replaced by someone's perception of it. It is significant when someone's perception of your body aligns with your own understanding of your body, being seen instead of being perceived. When talking about bodies, we often think in hierarchies. When talking about fat bodies, sick bodies, we talk about better. I am chronically ill. I will not get better. better is a construct and the goalposts are always changing. None of us will ever really reach better. There will always be another better. Better is the default body, but even default bodies have a better they are told to strive for. Even improvement implies that your current body is not enough. Improvement implies invalidity. Your body is valid, your body is beautiful, your body is functional even when it doesn't function like other bodies. Improvement and better are tools to sell. We can only get better through consumption. Better is a billion-dollar industry. There is a difficult tension between bodily acceptance and trans experience that Sonia Renee Taylor works through well in The Body Is Not an Apology. We, as bodily activists, must acknowledge that for some trans people, changing parts of their body is necessary for survival and the alleviation of dysphoria. At the same time, as trans activists, we must acknowledge, despite the gut instinct to say that won't work for me, that radical self-love is an incredibly useful and revolutionary tool. It is very hard at times to even consider that we may one day feel comfortable about parts of our bodies we currently want to change or remove. It can feel impossible. I want to honour and respect that difficulty. I want to acknowledge that this won't work for everyone. I sit in both of these spaces. There are still parts of my body I would like or need, I'm still not sure which, to change. But there are other parts of my body that I feel no longer need changing. The act of reading collaboration of The Body Is Not an Apology led me to this space. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I'm also interested in notions of bodily change that capitalism and normativity haven't got yet. In Pittsburgh, there is a conference called Please Try This at Home on Radical Bodily Autonomy and Biotechnology. Their tagline is Queer Cyborgs Wanted. So many trans people are already engaging in this practice because the medical establishment refuses to recognize them. We share knowledge about the treatments we need to survive, we purchase what we need in online black markets, and we become more knowledgeable than the medical establishment anyway. This once grassroots movement is growing and growing. We now have an international trans healthcare professional organization by and for trans people. We have a similar organization in Aotearoa. I am interested in the ways we necessarily professionalize and legitimize, co-opting capital and normativity ourselves in order to improve things for others, for those utilizing that black market, and for those that cannot even access that black market. I myself operate professionally in healthcare spaces. I worry sometimes about the way this professionalization has closed doors even as it has opened others. In the collaborative workshop, we discussed healthcare contexts, especially around mental health. Someone shared their experience of working in these spaces and the suspicion the institution held about encouraging creative collaboration between patients. The fear that bringing these people together will worsen their health for some reason or another. This is a fear. Doctors were not able to discern how others with shared experiences of mental distress could possibly provide healing the doctors were not already capable of. Been thinking and writing more about bodies, my body, my relationship with my body, how my body relates to other bodies. Collaboration requires vulnerability. I find vulnerability hard, but this is a project I am committed to. I will grow because it is necessary. Bodies are complex and complicated and have many layers. Sometimes my layers clash with your layers. How do we work through that? Holding and nurturing an understanding of the ways our bodies align and the ways they don't is critical to moving forward. Collaboration on personal matters can be difficult, but it is possible and rewarding. We acknowledge that, as queer and trans folk, we all carry complex traumas. Sometimes these traumas may interact weirdly or conflict with each other. Hold space for that and be gentle. We have run a small, personal, intimate and domestic queer space for nearly 3 years. We all hold traumas, and these traumas have conflicted. For example, trans folk transitioning from different directions will occasionally meet in the middle in ways that might clash. Understanding this and holding space for each other's feelings is essential. Recently, an online celebrity of sorts implied that encouraging acceptance of non-binary folk and the pronouns they use makes it hard for binary trans folk. This may be true for this person, and others may feel the same way, but there are ways through and around this. Working through this requires radical acceptance. It requires love. It requires being able to step back from your traumas while still holding them in tenderness along with the trauma of others, the hardest thing. I think the way forward must include open communication and good faith and holding space for love, understanding, and a willingness to appreciate each other's experiences. This was the spirit in which the workshop was held. People were invited to contribute and share and discuss our experiences, their similarities and differences. As queer and trans folk, the traumas we hold often lead us to a gut reaction of lashing out or shutting down. This is an understandable response. When so many spaces are hostile or dangerous, it is safer to assume the worst. It means we will be sure to avoid the worst, and the good that we avoid as a result is a necessary cost. It is hard to be vulnerable. It is the work of creating safe, comfortable, loving and understanding spaces to exist and collaborate in that aids us in starting to shift away from this position of fear and distrust. Hold space for that and be gentle.
Thank you for listening to episode 6 of Art Not Science. Tune in again in January 2020 for the second part of Hamster 5. Enjoy the summer holidays. Mā te wā.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, Resine Paints, and the Crater Rim.